Today, we had Senate Bill 44, Civil Liability and Skiing Accidents. We announced that we would bring that bill back before the Finance Committee next Tuesday or Wednesday. I think it was Wednesday we finally settled on. I can't remember for sure. But in the meantime, too, I'd like to establish a subcommittee to review it between now and then. And the subcommittee will consist of Representative Parnell as chairman and Representative Hanley and Representative Navarre as members. So if you three would take that bill and spend some time on it and bring it back to us approximately next Wednesday if you can.
Mr. Chairman.
You can if you want.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown?
I say if they will announce the time of the subcommittee, I will try to get my amendments to the subcommittee.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Martin?
Could I have that bill after the subcommittee finishes with it? Being a slow loner, I may have a lot of difficulty with 13 pages.
we will have to take your consideration.
We're going to get a private tutor.
I just got in here. Are you owly this morning or what?
The Senate had you and one of mine bills with one.
I think what Representative Martin is telling us that some House bills haven't been moving too fast over in the other body.
There's been one in Rules Committee for a year and 2 months.
I see.
One page bill. Awful difficult.
Representative Navarre?
Chairman, there are some House bills that haven't been moving too fast.
Yes.
That's right.
I had the same problem.
At the
too,
beginning
Mr.
of last year, Representative Martin introduced a couple of bills that are in our committee.
Yes, some of them almost 8, 9 years. I may stay around to get some passed.
I'd like to take up the bills in the following order this morning. I'd like to start with House Bill 199. In regards to House Bill 324, the Extend the Board of Dental Examiners, we're going to hold that one until tomorrow morning. There's a budget and audit meeting at noon today that an audit is due to be released on the Board of Dental Examiners. And I'd like an opportunity to be able to see what that audit says before we move the bill from committee in case we have any recommendations from the audit in regards to it. So we'll reschedule House Bill 324 to our meeting tomorrow morning. And then we'll move to House Bill 183, Transportation Corridors, Fairbanks to Nome. So our first bill is committee substitute for House Bill 199, Oil and Gas. Does have a zero fiscal note. It's an act relating to exploration and production of oil and gas and related hydrocarbons to oil and gas exploration license into oil and gas leases in certain areas of the state and providing for an effective date, and is sponsored by the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas, and its sponsors here are Representative Joe Green. Mr. Green, welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to preface my presentation to the plan that just went awry was that I would, as sponsor, ramble on an overview, and then we would have the expert, Ken Boyd, from the Department of Natural Resources, by teleconference, lead through the bill as it is. Apparently, we're having some difficulty with a teleconference, so what I think I still should do is to give an overview and then be available. We have Jerry Gallagher in the audience, too, who would be available to answer questions, and if there happens to be a question that neither of us can answer, we can get back to you. But of all the committees that, certainly in the House, that would be so painfully aware that our revenue stream has been abruptly decreased, the fact that we, for years, depended some 85% for our revenue stream from the petroleum industry, in fact, reaching as high as 95% when crude oil was up in the $30 range. I can't tell you now what the current percentage is, but it still represents well over 50%. And so it behooves us as a resource state to do what we can to continue to encourage the exploration and development of this vital resource. We have, under current law, a leasing schedule that is prepared and administered by the Department of Natural Resources, more specifically the Division of Oil and Gas. This is a leasing program that takes various portions of the state that are requested by members of the industry or on its own volition as the Department of Natural Resources to propose on a five-year running schedule small areas for lease sale, the most recent of which was the lease sale 78 in the Cook Inlet. That, having said that, I need to bring you aware, if you're not already, that of the petroleum companies that have at one time operated or at least been involved with the state of Alaska, more than half of them have now left the state. Partly, obviously, because of crude price, partly because of poor exploration results, partly because of issues that have been manifest on them by legislative acts. That too aside, I think it's now to the point, and I think the public is aware, that we are very, very dependent upon the oil industry, and that the precursor to the dollar that we get for the royalty oil that we sell, or for the ad valorem tax that we charge, or for the severance tax that we charge, is we first have to find that oil, and then develop that oil, and then market that oil. So if we go back to the very beginning, what we need to do as a state is to encourage the exploration for this vital substance we call hydrocarbon. That, as I said, is done to some degree with the current leasing program that we have. Unfortunately, that generally is associated with or near existing oil fields. And actually, in your package, you will see two maps that I will refer to in a few minutes. One with a square, sort of a, well, a rectangle at least, around the Cook Inlet, North Cook Inlet area. The other in the North Slope. And as I said, so many of the companies are leaving the state that we tried to cut some sort of a vehicle that would encourage both those that may have left and some perhaps that have not actually been involved in the state. That mechanism we've come to think is the, by various names, exploration licensing, large block licensing, track granting, whatever you may want to call it. What it does in effect, as opposed to the current leasing program, which every track 2 miles on a side is up for independent bidding and generally results in a checkerboarding of ownership, this bill would allow for a very juvenile example, if you will, an area that would be anywhere from a minimum of 20,000 acres to a maximum of 500,000 acres that can be put up on a license. It's not a lease, it's a license arrangement with the state that would allow that company or companies, and my background would tell me that it probably will be a combination of companies because of the expense, but at any rate, if they were to lease 500,000 acres, and let that represent the table, if you could imagine this table being checkerboarded under the present leasing schedule, and much smaller, now this could be licensed to a company or a group of companies that would come in and have the entire area to do what they feel they can do best. And they think it's over here, they drill a well, oh, that changes the picture, it's over here. That gives a lot of latitude to a company that's involved in trying to find this phantom thing called an oil or gas reservoir. And albeit they need to find something, as you probably have seen in the past, large enough to justify going into the hinterland, and that's what this bill addresses. Those remote sites, excluding those portions that are shown in your map, there would be no licensing within the North Cook Inlet area or north of the Umiak Base Meridian. So this would say that the rest of the state-owned property that is exclusive of those two areas would be available for a company or companies to approach the Commissioner of Natural Resources with a proposal to get a license in a certain area, whatever that may be. For example, we might use the Manchumina Basin. They would make their present or their ideas known. If the commissioner then finds that that is in the best interest of the state, he will then notice that this area, the Manchumina Basin, or 500,000 acres, or 200, or whatever the size was, would be being put up for competitive bid, just the same way our leasing program does now, that anybody, any company, individual, group of individuals who wants to competitively bid on the right to go into this license area would submit those bids. Now, the awarding of that bid then, instead of dollars up front, the idea behind this is to have those dollars go to ground truth, as it were, to actually drill into the earth, do seismic work, whatever, to try and locate a hydrocarbon field or fields. The competitive bids then are opened, and if, again, the commissioner finds that there is an adequate response, it's a work commitment, and for the sake of example, since it's numbers that I can barely understand, but let's supposing Company A or Company A et al. Won the bid for this particular license area at $100 million worth of work commitment. And the commissioner finds that that is, in fact, to the state's interest because he is granting the exclusive licensing for oil and gas. Now, that doesn't exclude anything else, lumbering, mining, or any other additional use that might be available on that same parcel of ground. But from an oil gas standpoint, this Company A now has the exclusive right for up to 10 years to look around in there and try and find oil. They have committed to $100 million, or it might be $1 billion, but at any rate, some number that won the bid for them, was approved by the commissioner. They have a requirement that every year they will post a bond. Now, this is exclusive, again, of any of the work commitment bonds like DEC may require or any of the environmental bonds. Those are still going to be there. But this is a work commitment bond that says that Company A will, by the formula of what was bid minus what has been done, and that has been done has to be approved by the commissioner. They can't buy popcorn sticks or popcorn bags or something. It has to be related to exploration and approved by the commissioner. That numerator divided by the number of years left on the license is the amount of money they have to post if they do not do. In other words, let's take the $100 million. They haven't done anything in the first year. They divide it by 10. There's a $10 million bond that they have to post in favor of the state. In the first year, Company A says, boy, we've got some reversals. We really can't do anything in Alaska this year except pay the state $10 million. Now, for simplicity of math, let's say that in the second year, they do $55 million worth of work. They do some some seismic work and drill a well, and that's about $55 million. So at year two, they've got 100 minus 55, which is 45, divided by 9. Their bond that year then would be $5 million. And so it goes until they've actually expended the amount of money approved by the commissioner toward their original bid. There are a couple of caveats that I think are of particular interest to the state. One says that if after the fourth year they have not committed to at least 25%, $25 million as it were, they lose everything. It's pulled from them and the state is, they can do anything they want. They've lost their license. If they have spent over half by the fourth year, there is no penalty as far as relinquishment of acreage, and I'll address that in a minute. So now we're addressing this. What if they have done something between $50 million and $25 million? After year four, they haven't spent 50%. They would lose 25% of this area. And until they spend at least 50%, they will lose 10% thereafter, up to another 50%. So it's conceivable that even though they do their work commitment to keep the license, they've lost three quarters of it. And this, again, of course, is an incentive to do your work early, as opposed to, unfortunately, the problem we have with conventional leasing now, that if I go out and lease and I get a 10-year lease, I can actually defer for up till, say, the ninth year before I'm really committed. There's no time crunch other than the payment of $1, $2, or up to $3 an acre, which, when you're dealing with something as expensive as exploratory drilling, that's really not very much money. This, in just the opposite, it encourages the person who has the license to move their expenditures forward. If I have done that, and after 3 or 4 years, I find, boy, like so many cases, 90% of all exploratory wells, there's just doesn't seem to be anything here, I can relinquish it, or, and then the state, of course, gets that track back. Now, let's supposing that in this situation that Company A was successful over here in finding what they feel to be a commercial oil field. Now, there's a lot of things and a lot of hoops that would require before that ever gets to the pipeline. But they have found it, and they now would want to convert this to a lease rather than just a license. There is a provision in the bill that allows that. Again, the ground rules of how much area is involved is a function of the commissioner, actually the Division of Oil and Gas, and the Company A to determine just how much is reasonably associated with this. It might be 10,000 acres, 5,000 acres. It's certainly going to be far less than the total license area. They could convert that to lease, give up the rest. They could convert that to lease and continue for the full 10-year period. And what they spend on this after it's discovered, let's say they drill 5 more wells, delineation type wells, those dollars are not deducted from their commitment. They still have the commitment as long as they have part of the tract, not a lease, a part of a license area, not a lease. That, in a nutshell, is about what 199 is all about. You might think of it as a companion to our conventional leasing, albeit that it's much bigger. It's more rigidly defined as far as what is required of the person. It's converting, instead of a bonus, it's converting to work commitment to actually get the work done and hopefully discover. In your packets, I think you'll find a pie chart. The amount of money the state has reserved, even with the $900 million that it got in the Prudhoe-Bailey sale, the amount of money that the state has received from oil and gas operations is essentially after production starts, not the upfront money. Only a small percentage of our total money has come from leasing. So whether someone might say, well, gee whiz, the bonus bid would be better than the work commitment, that pie chart belies that, indicating that it's far, far better that they put the money in the ground, find more oil, and develop it, because that's where the money for the state comes from. And so with that, I'll be open to any sorts of questions, since we can't have the bill's author here. And Jerry, if you would like to, if there are any questions, one of the two of us should be able to answer.
Sure, we could have Gary come up here. Do we have any questions? Representative Grusendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In listening to your presentation and the concept of the licensing for exploration, it sounds kind of interesting, but I look at the checkerboard pattern, let's say, for the competitive bidding as being pretty fierce at times, with a lot of speculation and very much like a lottery, but it is a game of chance, hopefully with a little skill, by the people that have been, you know, looking at it. To me, by opening up a larger block, you take out some of the front-end money that the state might get for the bonus aspect and the speculation of those people that are bidding, and we'd lose, you know, that aspect of it. Because a lot of times in exploration, you're not going to find anything, but you did pay for the right to do the exploration and that sort of thing. I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of look at this as giving a lot of latitude to the commissioner to do things with state assets, when just the other day we were not even willing to allow weights and measures to go to the commissioner of the Department of Transportation. and this goes... Well, that's the problem. There are some commissioners in this case, one would say, yes, by gosh, he would do that in the best interest of the state. But there's others, sometimes we pass judgment by the person that's in that office. And I guess the question is, who's going to be the commissioner of the natural resource that we'd have that trust in?
If I might, Representative Grusendorf brings up several points. I hope that I cover them all. If I don't, please pull my feet to the fire. But one, who's going to be the commissioner is absolutely a fair question. Who's going to be governor to appoint that commissioner is certainly a question. But I think if we first reflect that Alaska is a resource state, it's to the state's best interest to develop its resources, albeit this should be done in an environmentally satisfactory and an economically satisfactory method. But we do, regardless of who the commissioner has been, and if you look back over the last 20 years, there has been a significant degree of latitude of who the commissioner might have been. But in each case, regardless of what party affiliation happened to have the governor's seat, the commissioners, I feel, to at least some degree, were very interested in environmentally sensitive development of our resources. What happens as far as not having a checkerboard situation and the fierce competition that we have sometimes on some lathes, some sales, and we have a member of your body who held this position at one time and is certainly aware that sometimes you throw a party and nobody comes. I mean, we've gone from the point of absolutely no one showing up to a lease sale to fierce competition. And the major difference in that is, A, it's proximity to the ability to ship out what they found, or it's proximity to a discovery, or it's direct proximity to something that is essentially known to have some hydrocarbons. And I'll offer a couple of examples to that. The $900 million that was received, largest lease sale bonus we've ever had, was goat pasture. The goodies were leased in 1964, and it was after the discovery on the North Slope that some goat pasture, downstructure in other words, non-productive portions, were put up for lease sale. It's that, after the fact, after the major discovery, that caused the competitive, fierce lottery type, I'll do anything to get. And essentially none of that's been productive. It was that which was done before that. The competitive leasing that was done, for example, following the ARCO discovery in the Cook Inlet was another situation like that. And that's probably one of the benefits that people show for competitive leasing, that the company that knew the most about that far and away bid the highest amount, and what they say left money on the table, they left about 90% of their bid on the table because they wanted to be sure they got it. They were so convinced that what was adjacent to the land that they already had was good that they were going to be willing to bid high, the lottery. I'll buy the whole ream of tickets rather than just one. But when you're talking about the areas that would be used under this bill, it's miles, tens, hundreds of miles from any known, even any drill areas. It's absolutely out in the hinterlands. And so the biggest concern is not whether or not we have lost the upfront dollars of bidding that should be of concern. It's primarily whether or not we can encourage somebody at all to come in and exercise this. Because you not only have the unknown nature, and by that means that the historical relation between exploratory wells drilled and discoveries is extremely low. It is a true lottery, in effect, only there are some cagier or luckier or more informed people at times, but albeit the odds are very low. If we don't encourage people to come in here, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought momentarily. The other side of that coin is that even if you find something in a remote area, let's say the men's human abatement, getting the right to get that discovery, if it's big enough to justify the infrastructure, to a market some way, either to the coast and ships or back to the TAPS pipeline or some way that they can get what they've got to the cash register, is going to be a major part of their bid. They've got nature to deal with, they've got the environment to deal with, they've got economics to deal with. And so I submit to you, Representative, that the state would certainly not be losing anything. If that were the case, we would have already had someone out there trying to find it in these remote sites already. This is an incentive. We're hoping to get somebody to say, hey, that looks pretty good. I'm willing to take, when I multiply the chance factors of those three things that I told you about, discovery, environment, and economics, the chances of finding something get down in the fractional interest rate. So in order to go out there and find anything that's worthwhile, it has to be a humongous find in order to be economic. Most people would not do that on a checkerboard basis because they would be subject to only getting a portion of that. So that's what this is all about.
Mr. Chairman, just another thought here on the bonus bidding, on the bidding for these checkerboard things. That bid money, a lot of it is earmarked for the permanent fund in the front end, is it not? Now the question would be, what does the licensing aspect do in relation with the revenues that go in the permanent fund, all from speculation?
If I might, the design of this bill is not to have the company who wins the bid directly bring money to the state. So there's no bonus bid from the amount of money that is committed to try and find oil. What would be committed is the discovery once it's made. Then the land around, reasonably around this, that is not converted to lease would be subject to competitive bidding on a lease basis. Then you again go back to the checkerboarding because now it's not an untapped, untested, remote potential. This now is a proven area, and that then falls into the same category that you have in the excluded areas now. So the state's benefit is trying to find it, and then let's get some money for it. But you don't want to discourage that which would be used to try and find it in the first place, if I haven't made that more confusing.
Gambling's a big industry.
Okay, Representative Terrio.
I wanted to touch on what I think a lot of the critics of this legislation are making statements about the fact that these are large areas that are going to be licensed over to the oil companies or going to lock them up. But you made comments about, you know, the timber on the land wouldn't be affected, the mining potential. And I think we need to make that clear. Just exactly what restrictions would there be placed on this large area? The oil and gas company has the right to poke the holes, but what restrictions do we have on the surface? And I think the concern is that it will be just like Prudhoe Bay, where you get up to a checkpoint and you can't go past the checkpoint because they've got that land on the lease. So what's the answer there?
I'll defer to Jerry on that one. Gallagher, DNR.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jerry Gallagher. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. The presence of a exploration license or an oil lease is not in itself an exclusion to public access. And the provisions of public access that are already in the law, I believe under AS 3805-130, would apply. Operators are allowed to prevent public access for reasons of safety, health, and certain security reasons. But the state's land is generally subject to concurrent uses, and whether that's oil development or mining or timber, those same rules would apply here. This doesn't change any of that, and if an exploration license were granted for 500,000 acres, that doesn't grant an exclusive use of the surface in any way, shape, or form. The rules that are already in effect would still apply.
So if somebody wants to stake a mineralized area or timber company wants to come in and they make a proposal on the land, they could do that. It all take place at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Terrio, that is correct.
Okay, any further questions to these two gentlemen? Representative Henley.
Yeah, I just wanted you to make it clear again that this, the exclusions in here and the reasons for them, maybe you could go over that again. I hear what you're saying is that those areas that have already been tapped or largely have the most potential are excluded. Is that how the exclusions were drawn in here?
This was a, if I might, Mr. Chairman, this was an agreed-to area of exclusion, and I might say, I wish Mr. Boyd were here. He did a yeoman's task of working with the industry and with the legislature to, I won't say the legislature, I take that back, with members of the legislature, to try and build, as Jerry talked about, a three-legged stool between the legislature, the industry, and
the administration.
The administration, thank you. The concept is that this area that is known to have production in it, or certainly speculated to be close to having production in it, was a major point of controversy. Would it be fair, and I think Representative Krusendorf touched on this, to say that, well, there's production where my cup is, but here's an area that hasn't been leased, so we'll take a great big license area out here and have exclusive right to look around. Obviously, that wouldn't be fair. So there was an area around each of the known producing areas that would be subjected to exclusion from this potential and would still be, and there were also some lease areas. There's an area that's subject to lease bid that dips south of the Umiak, and it should show on your map. That area also will be excluded in granting any license. And if this becomes law, and later, as I mentioned on this hypothetical, if they find oil in a certain area, that too, by the commissioner's office, would be excluded. It's only those undrilled, untapped, unknown areas that this bill is supposed to address.
Representative Rusenberg?
How about offshore leases? Would that be part of this? Could a person get licenses for exploring offshore?
It would be difficult to imagine a large, say something greater than 20,000 potentially, but certainly not 500,000 because of the irregular, the encouragement in the bill says that it should be somewhat contiguous and be more reasonably dimensioned. But yes, it could happen that there would be some offshore area if it was any kind of a major concession. It would probably include both onshore and offshore if it were offshore. It wouldn't just be offshore. But you've got to remember that the commissioner has wide latitude, as I think he should, as a natural resource state. The commissioner here still doesn't have, for example, the latitude that his counterpart would have in the province of Alberta. It's almost a warlord there. But sometimes something akin to that is necessary. If he contemplates that there's going to be some competitive lease sales coming up in the area that Company A wanted to come in, which included some offshore, he just has the prerogative to not grant that as a concession.
Mr. Chairman, of course, when you're talking about the Commissioner of Natural Resources in Alberta and whatnot, I believe that he probably is an elected official who is in the majority of the government, who is then selected by the majority party, as opposed to appointee.
That's true. It happens to be a her, but you're right. That doesn't exclude the commissioner, as may have happened, you may be aware of, that doesn't exclude the commissioner because he's not elected from any public scrutiny. He reports to a gentleman, or so far in the state, he reports to a position that is elected. And so his machinations are certainly in the public eye and subject to public scrutiny.
Further questions? Representative Brown.
Thank you. Is a licensee or a person seeking to acquire one of these licenses required to show a geologic prospect or some specific reason that they think this area merits exploration?
In order to get a favorable nod from the commissioner, there would have to be some reason to want to tie up this kind of land. And that could be anything from surface geology to magnetic surveys flown at a certain height over it to various situations like that. But you've got to remember, there probably won't be subsurface ground truth, because that's the whole purpose of this bill. So it's going to have to be a concept rather than actually being able to go and say, here's this well, look at this well data.
Well, I guess I was just thinking about the possibility of a company coming in and saying, generally, like in the Bristol Bay area, we think this whole offshore area is prospective, and we just want this whole strip here. And it would certainly be contiguous, and I guess you could pick up a little bit of the uplands there and just say, you know, under this bill, what would prevent just a large sweeping expanse of coastline and offshore lands from being licensed in that manner?
Well, as I said, they have to make a presentation to the commissioner, who has on his own staff or her own staff professionals who deal with subsurface information. On something as large as this, there is a budget provision within the DNR oil and gas division that allows for consultation with professionals, licensed professional engineers, geologists, to review. And if I were to come in and say I would like to have a 500,000-acre concession, just happens to abut the Bristol Bay area and does include the 3 mile out to the 3 mile limit, and I've got this sixth sense that there's going to be something found there. If I were to go, for this example, Jerry happens to be the commissioner, and he looks at me in the eye and says, wait a minute, there's got to be more than just a gut-wrench feel. What have you got to substantiate this? I haven't gone to the point of any aerial magnetometer work. I haven't got anything from a surficial indication. I'm trying to just tie up some property. And he says, sorry, Charlie.
Well, but what if what they're willing to do is say, but we'll spend $50 million drilling out there. We don't want to tell you where, because it might leak out, and we're concerned about confidentiality, and we aren't really quite sure where we want to go anyway, but we guarantee we'll drill so many wells.
It's still up to the commissioner to either accept or reject that. It's not a gut sense that the high bid might be $50 million, and he has to grant it. There's nothing in the statute that says that he has to grant a concession or a license.
Can I continue?
Sure.
Thank you. Do the exclusions in state law that prohibit leasing in Bristol Bay apply also to this provision?
This would not override any existing restrictions.
If that's true, why are there so many little provisions in this bill where it says this section applies and this section applies and this one applies here? Would you like me to enumerate what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Specifically, the section that enumerates which portions of 3805.180 apply, such as on page 8 at line 25, line 24. I believe there are other places in the bill as well where we're specifying that particular parts of 180 apply. If everything that's in state law applies, why is it necessary to delineate this in this way?
Well, for one thing, it's in state law. A company now has the right to hold, through competitive bidding, albeit, productive or non-productive acreage up to 500,000 acres. That 500,000 acres would be excluded from this 500,000. In other words, a company, let's say a company like BP or ARCO, who may already have through wherever they've leased, they've got 500,000 acres already under lease, they would not be prohibited from exercising the licensing. So that would be an exclusion to what's existing in state law. So I overstated that every exclusion that is now in state law would be adhered to. That's not quite true because of
But you're certain that the Bristol Bay exclusion
I don't know that. We
can look into
find
that?
Out. Sure.
That's an issue of concern. Can I continue?
Good. Let's go.
Thank you. What is the difference in the relationship between a lessee and a licensee?
One has the right to go into this unknown area. That's a licensee. All he has is the license to explore. He has no other specific right, as Jerry indicated. He cannot exclude for any reason any other use for which that area has provision for an acceptable use. Once he converts a portion of that to a lease, then he becomes a lessee. And that grants, with that lease, he is given additional rights that he doesn't have as a licensee. The license grants him the right to find. The lease grants him the right to exploit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess the point I'm getting at is our existing leases grant the right to find, to explore, to produce. What responsibilities is one relieved of by having a license as opposed to having a lease?
Well, the state is not willing to commit, I would hope, to commit to a lease. That's an ownership that he has, as long as he has that lease, to do certain activities on that area and to exploit what he finds and ship that to market. But there's no way that the person who is under a license can, for example, drill, discover, find, and transport the product. He doesn't have that right in a license.
But, Mr. Chairman, he would have, it seems to me that he essentially does have the right, because you've sold him kind of a continuing phase package. You've sold him a package that says, upon discovery, you shall have the right to convert to a lease. So what's the fundamental difference there? I'm just having trouble understanding, why are we stringing this out, giving it a new name, setting up a whole new chapter to deal with it, when we have, why not just take our existing thing, and if the leases are too small, allow bigger leases? Because it seems like really that's fundamentally what you're doing in this bill.
Well, for one thing, then you're granting an additional set of privileges, because you get the right to convert, but that takes an additional act. If you were to grant a $500,000 leasing privilege, then the state suffers, because then the state doesn't get what it would normally get as either a bonus or a commitment to produce those things that would be required when he converts a portion of this land that he had to license to look for. Now he's converting to a lease to exploit from, and I don't know why there's a problem in understanding the difference in the ownership of what you actually have. License gives you no right to develop. It only gives you the right to find.
Okay, I guess I would read this bill to say that a find under a license does indeed give you the right to convert to a lease and to produce.
Yeah, it does
so
give you the right to
convert. So we don't have any discretion
convert.
To say no at the point.
Oh,
that someone,
yes.
At the point that someone has made a discovery?
Absolutely, because the commissioner again says, now when you have this lease, you are going to have to do certain things. And I say, well, gee whiz, I don't want to do that. He will be committed to additional limits because of the lease than he would have as a license. How he, for example, is going to go about development, what amount of acreage would be involved in the lease, those are restrictions that the commissioner can impose upon him.
Mr. Chairman, does the bill not say that at the time the license is granted, the form of the lease to be issued shall be made available at that point?
Exactly. At that point.
What is the trigger that allows conversion to lease? What's required to convert to a lease?
He would have to come back. The company A would have to come. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Would have to come back to the commissioner and show just cause as to why he should be converting from a speculative right to find to a commitment to the right to exploit A, the commissioner would want to find out what it is that he's going to exploit. Does he have an oil field? Well, he found 6 feet of pay. Obviously, that's not going to convert to a lease because that's uneconomic.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I had been under the presumption that you had to make a discovery to convert. Now I look on page 8 at the section there, and it doesn't say that. It says if the commissioner determines the work commitment is met, there may be a conversion.
Maybe.
And then that gives you an additional 10 years?
It would be dependent upon the restrictions of the lease. There are some 5-year leases. They're not automatic 10-year leases.
But normally they are 10 years, and that is the practice of the department.
It has been in the competitive lease sale. But there are...
I have a couple more, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let me just ask a question first. How many in the audience wanted to testify? How many more do we have to testify today? Okay, one more. Okay, go ahead, Representative Brown, and then
okay.
Representative Grusendorf, and then we're going to go back to testimony.
Thank you. One of the issues, I think, with this bill is whether it provides a fair competitive opportunity for companies that are interested in exploration in Alaska, whether it encourages competition or not. With respect to the process, when it is initiated by a prospective licensee instead of by the commissioner, when this licensee initiates it under this window that the commissioner is obligated to provide, is it possible then that no other company would have the opportunity to get in on that opportunity? Or how would that work? I see here there's this opportunity for public comments, but is it expressed that another company could come in and say, well, we'll make a better offer than that one? And would the commissioner have to reveal the specifics of the offer? Could you elaborate on how that will work?
Mr. Gallagher?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I can respond generally to that. And again, I apologize that Ken Boyd wasn't available on the teleconference. But there's two routes to go down, as you said. There's one where the commissioner can open up for a time-specific period for proposals. And then there's a second where a single application for a license is received and as I read on page 7, line 3, when that single proposal is received, the commissioner has the authority to either reject it or to public notice that the commissioner will consider it. I don't read the language to provide for entertaining additional competitive proposals. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are some words on page 8 about competing proposals when they're submitted and the highest bidder gets the competing proposal.
Yes, that... Mr. Chairman, Representative McClain, that is when there is multiple proposals, mm-hmm. and then they're compared on a dollar-to-dollar work commitment basis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Brown?
Oh. Thank you.
Representative Green?
Yes, and the other condition on page 7 does mention under F2, if only one proposal is received, then they go through these machinations. It's the intent that even though Company A may be the initiator, that there will be through either knowledge, public offering, whatever, that there will be additional people who have the right to. They may not elect to, but there would be preferably more than one person involved, more than one company.
Well, I guess I don't quite see how that would work, because if our intent is to encourage competition, and I guess that's one of the things that's I'm a little uneasy about in going to this wide open or allowing one company to tie up a very large amount of land. If you have a window, and say it's 30 days and it's the month of March, and at the very last day of March, Company A comes in and says, we want to make this license or propose this license, the commissioner looks at that and is looking at, now there hasn't been a competitive bid, there's just been that company's offer to drill so many wells, and the commissioner say, well, there's nothing happening there, that looks pretty good, let's go with it. And so they put out a notice saying, we intend to award Company A this license, this concession. Now, where is the opportunity for anybody else to come in and say, well, we've been gathering seismic data there, we might have an interest in that. That's part of the reason that you have a five-year leasing schedule, so that people who might be interested can prepare, gather information, do evaluation, and it seems like there's the potential for cutting some of those companies who may have been, you know, considering it and just didn't come forward at that particular moment out of the process for a very long time.
Well, do you want to address the public interest estimates findings? Is that part of the requirement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I guess I have a more general comment. And the intent of this tool in the state's oil and gas leasing program is to allow individuals or companies to put their money into the ground in those areas that perhaps probably the state may think there's low potential. For whatever reason, it's not on the state's oil and gas leasing program. And it's those areas that that perhaps the companies or an individual believes that that they have a better idea than the state does. We may not think the potential is very high or it warrants being high on the list of places to lease, but they do. This is going to allow them the opportunity to invest their money, and I think this idea needs to be viewed from that perspective. And if their idea is right and they find something, then that is going to increase the competition. But this is to look at areas where there seems to be very little interest right now, but if somebody's got a good idea and they can find something, so much the better, and that's what's going to increase the competition. And I think it's a valuable tool in the state's oil and gas program.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying I don't think it could be a valuable tool. I'm just thinking about the relationship of the competitive process and why, for example, would we not want to exclude all sales that are now on the five-year leasing program? Because the fact that they've gotten onto the leasing program probably means somebody had some interest in it, and either the state geologists or the industry suggested that those should be offered in the future. And that would be an example, a concrete example. Say you have a sale that's scheduled 5 years out. So companies now know that that's in the future, and maybe they are starting to expend resources to prepare for it. And then we have this possibility for truncating those sales where people have already started preparing. Why is that a good idea? I mean, why is that set up in this manner in this bill?
I can't answer that. The only thing I can suggest is that the companies either who have or who have expressed an interest in conducting activities within the state have agreed that this is a bill that they can live with, which says, in effect, then, if there are 18 or 20 companies in this category that Mr. Boyd met with, and that there was a potential for a conflict or an unfair advantage, somebody, I think, would have probably raised that. But that's a poor answer to your question.
I have a couple
Mr.
more.
Mr. Gallagher?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, in response to that, on page 3, line 4, there's a section that requires the commissioner to go through a written process that ultimately designate which lands will be available for this that are beyond the exclusion areas of the North Slope and Cook Inlet. And I think those are the sorts of issues that would be discussed during the commissioner's consideration.
Okay, on that point, Chairman, please.
Well, on the point of the conversion to a lease, if you are converting to a lease once the exploration has taken place. Is there any public input during that time?
There would be. The conversion, anytime there is a granting of a lease, there would have to be a public, or a best interest finding. And I'm not sure, but I believe that that requires public input.
Yeah. My, Mr. Chairman, Representative McClain, my understanding, the requirements of this bill, the best interest finding under 3805.035 would be done prior to the issuance of the license.
Prior to the issuance of the license?
License.
Okay, then, once you're converting to a lease, do you go through another public process?
No.
So there's no public process during that time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McClain, I will have to get back to you on the specifics of that to answer your questions directly.
We have to take a look.
Did we ever get Ken Boyd on teleconference? What is the problem? Do we know? Does that mean they're on other teleconferences? I'd like a list of what those other teleconferences are.
While we're waiting, can I continue with my questioning on the conversion to a lease? Now, once you're converting to a lease, how much land could be conveyed to that company? All of it, or
no,
how many?
That would depend on the reasonable geology of the find that they've made. It would be a restriction to that which is conceivable in the eyes of the commissioner to be associated with that discovery.
There is, from a conversion to a lease, it's subject to acreage limitations. What is the acreage limitations?
It depends on the size of the find.
No. Chairman?
I'm sorry.
My understanding is that the acreage limitation she's referring to is the one in 3805.140C, where it says...
Yes.
One company can hold a maximum of 500,000 onshore and 500,000 offshore.
Right.
And this, we're providing in this bill that licenses are outside of that.
I see.
Then once you convert to a lease, the way I read it, then you would be under the acreage limitation in 3805.140.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. That's right.
Okay, Representative Grusendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I'm hearing here is a proposal that is submitted to DNR can end up in a license, and the extent or privileges that are attached to this license have me kind of baffled at this point, because I have to equate it to things that I'm familiar with. Now, if I get a commercial fishing license, which permits me to go and try to fish, doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to catch anything. It doesn't necessarily guarantee me an area exclusive for me to do my fishing expedition and my fishing exploration. There's other people that likewise would have licenses that in turn are also seeking their fortunes there. Now, does a license be exclusive to that area? As if I get a automobile license, the obvious, the road is not exclusive to me, but I certainly may use it for commercial reasons and for private reasons. And this is what's bothering me, is the concept of the license aspect, and does it preclude anyone else from coming into this area? And what I'm hearing is, yes, it does. Now, that doesn't quite equate into my idea of the licensing, be it for use of aerial radio airwaves or whatever it is, common property. How can you explain this to me, to a simple fishing market?
Through the chair, Representative Grusendorf, your license in your fishing example is the right to take and to bring in and harvest.
Mm-hmm.
This license is not that. The lease is the mechanism by which...
But that's automatic.
It's automatic in the area of discovery.
Then you get an
IFQ. Like your
then you get an IFQ.
Through the chair, like the set netters, have exclusive license
to put their net in a certain area and catch those fish. That's more akin to what this is, once it's converted to lease, but not during the license phase.
Okay. What I'm going to do at this time is call upon Mr. Jeff Cook for his testimony, but if Mr. Gallagher and Representative Green would stick around, please.
There are a couple more areas that I have, one of which specifically affects the department, and that's to talk about the fiscal note. Mm-hmm. So would that, can they come back?
They will come, be coming back.
Also set many sites or at least state.
Welcome, Jeff.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Cook, and I'm the Director of Government and Public Relations in Northern Alaska for ARCO, and I do reside and work out of Fairbanks for ARCO, Alaska. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. ARCO does support the committee substitute for House Bill 199 that's before you today as a strong frontier licensing bill, and we particularly want to point out some of the strengths that it has in providing a level playing field for potential competitors. First of all, the bonding formulation strikes an appropriate balance amongst a variety of interests to provide equal financial footing for bidders and solid protection for the state's interest. Second, leases are achieved only after the entire work commitment is completed, which minimizes chances for speculation. Third, the bonding and relinquishment provisions provide incentives to conduct the work early and vigorously. Fourth, the bonding provision allows the licensee the maximum flexibility to pursue a work program that makes sense. Fifth, the licensing supplements and also dovetails into the proven state leasing system, providing licensees with maximum certainty of the long-term rules. And finally, the winning bid in any competition is selected based upon the objective standards of total dollars amount using sealed bids. And we do appreciate the opportunity to offer our input, and thank you for consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions of Mr. Cook? No, thank you, sir. Did we have anyone else in the audience who wanted to be heard? Okay. Maybe if we could call then Mr. Gallagher and Representative Green back to the table. And would you continue, Representative Rowe?
Thank you. One thing I wanted to bring up is on page 8 at lines 26 and 27, we're specifying the royalty provision that would be in these leases that are converted. And I'm wondering why you chose that manner, or specifying the 12.5%, not less than 12.5%, as opposed to referencing the section of 3805-180F, where the bidding methods are listed for competitive leases, and which do specify other ways of configuring the monetary term of the lease other than just a fixed royalty.
I'm sorry, I was...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I can't answer that question, but we will get the answer to you. Sorry.
Okay. Another question I have, Mr. Chairman, is how many licenses can one company obtain?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Brown, Representative Brown, I'm sorry. I don't believe there's a limitation on the number of licenses.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn now to the fiscal note.
Okay. Before we do that, I know, Representative Brown, you had two or three questions now that haven't been answered. Maybe he could put those in writing for the gentleman. We'll get those answers before we move the bill.
You want me to put them in writing?
No.
Unless, I've been taking notes.
Do you have them written down what they are? No, we've had the last two questions. We had
Bristol
one
Bay,
in
how many
Bristol
license?
Bay.
Why is the bidding method specified in this manner? Those are the ones I noted.
Thanks to Liz Taylor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's obvious from looking at this bill that the commissioner is mandated to do certain things and then has discretion to do other things, and I'm just wondering how is this all going to be accomplished with zero resources?
This is John.
Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, first of all, the program is in great part at the discretion of the commissioner. The commissioner may do this, and the fiscal note notes that we believe we can, given current funding, we can accomplish this without additional resources. There's a section in the division that does best interest findings routinely, and we will just have to look at the applications and use the commissioner's discretion. But we believe that under our current funding scenario, we can accommodate this effort.
If I could continue on that point, it looks to me like the intent of this bill is to mandate this opportunity for proposals to be submitted, and I'm referring to the language at the bottom of page 6, lines 29 and 30. The commissioner's obligation at the top of page 7 in subsection D that he must respond to these things. We're saying here regulations must provide for this one-year period, which mandates that you have to go through the regulation process. Then mandatory, once a year, there'll be these proposals coming in a fairly short window of time in which to evaluate major decisions that have big money implications for the state's interest. And recently I've had the opportunity to talk to the director about the status of the state's program, and I don't think it's an overstatement to say that resources are in short supply, that there is considerable concern now as to whether the division under its current funding has adequate resources to meet the legal obligations that it has to be able to issue leases and keep the competitive program running as people would like to see it. Under that assumption that we aren't using enough resources today to thoroughly evaluate all the environmental considerations, to work with the public adequately, to give enough notice, to make maps available, think about the issues identified in the Ombudsman report, some of which I was told and led to believe were just a matter of resource allocation. You know, when you don't have enough money, you have to make choices. Therefore, it concerns me that we will be putting in a new program in a manner that requires it to happen without giving resources so that it can happen in a way that protects the state's interest.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, again, the fiscal note that the department submitted was zero, and we believe that we can accommodate this program. There is some flexibility in these sections for the commissioner to specify some lands and some other actions, and we think we can do the job.
Representative Green?
Yes, and I think where it says that at least once a year, when I talked to the commissioner about this, it was his attitude that he wasn't going to be holding a multiplicity of these things. The industry has certainly given no indication that there's going to be a mass rush for big bites of state acreage, that over a period of time that there may be as many as one a year, but there won't be a plethora of them. If that were to be the case, then I think that would be a fantastic situation, that the commissioner could come back or the director could come back and either ask for a supplement, or the following year could come in and show, hey, we've got 15 proposals for this large block leasing area, and we've really spurred the initiative of the industry, and we're going to be drilling a lot of areas, and it looks bright for the state. I couldn't think of a finer situation than that.
Mr. Chairman, would y'all object to changing the word must on page 6, line 29 to may? The regulations may provide for at least one period for that purpose during each calendar year.
Mr. Gallagher or Representative Green?
That would seem to be consistent with what you just said.
It would be. through the chair, I don't see any problem with that. It seems to me it weakens the bill in respect to the fact that at least one will be made available. May would indicate to me that he may or may not, which could mean a group of years in between. I personally don't see any problem with that, but what I would like to do, if we've got some other things to come back to you with, that it would probably be to all of our interest to come back and first touch base with the bill's author and see if that creates a problem. Personally, I don't see that it does.
What it would be my intent at this time would be to bring this bill up the first thing tomorrow morning at 8:30. In between now and 8:30, maybe we get those answers that Representative Brown has requested. Also, do we have any amendments that are pending on this bill? Representative Brown?
I didn't intend to make any, but I'll probably move to change must to may on page 6, line 29.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, I also, depending on the answer on this issue of the bidding methods, would like to consider a modification of that section on page 8, lines 26 and 27.
Mr. Chairman, to DNR, for me, you can find out how many state leases they are to set bill netters. Set netters.
Big word?
Sorry. How many state leases they are to set netters on state land.
Oh, boy.
Wouldn't do it.
I mean, you answered the question in relation with licenses, but I'm just kidding, but we know there are leases.
I'm happy to get that number for you, Representative.
No, I know there are leases.
Okay, so tomorrow morning at 8:30, we will start with House Bill 199, and if we have time, we will go to House Bill 324, which was the Extended Board of Dental Examiners that we moved tomorrow morning. And then we'll also roll in then House Bill 183, Transportation Corridors, into that meeting. So we have more bills than we're going to be able to get into tomorrow morning, but we'll just have to place them on a rolling calendar.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to make a comment that as the chairman of the DNR Budget Subcommittee, if I could go back in time, I think while we were flush with money, we would have spent a lot of money mapping this state, doing all kinds of geologic survey work. Right now, the agency is trying as best they can with the limited dollars that we have to do subsurface mapping of suspected mineralized areas. But what it appears we're trying to do here is entice somebody to do that work for us. We no longer have the money to do it. If we knew exactly where all of the state's resources were, there'd be no need for this bill. But what we're trying to do is entice somebody to do that work for us, and if they find it, then there's a potential payoff for them for taking that risk.
I think what you're saying, if we never do anything, we're never going to have any money to do anything.
Exactly. And we no longer have the money to do perhaps what we should have.
Anything else come before the meeting this morning that... also, what we don't accomplish tomorrow morning, which might be very much, we could roll over into tomorrow afternoon's calendar. But we do have House Bill 162, Capital Punishment for Murder, on the calendar for tomorrow afternoon at 1:30. And I don't want anyone to really rush to me, but we may need a subcommittee, and if we have any volunteers.
I would like to be on the subcommittee. I would like to chair the subcommittee.
Okay. Chairman McLean?
You're going to be the first victim.
Okay.
Terry, do you want to be on the
subcommittee? Probably the chairman of the subcommittee.
About being the first victim.
Okay, meeting's adjourned for this morning.
I'll see you.